Chapter 8. Acting in the World. Within relative reality, which is subsumed by absolute reality, there is a dualistic or complementary conception of behavior that ranges from ignorant at one end to enlightened at the other end. Of course, as with any complementary pair, one might define a number of intermediate positions between the anchor points at either end of the dimension or spectrum. Everything material is a manifestation of source, which creates an apparent dualism between matter and consciousness. Life plays an important role in this apparent dualism, which depends on subject-object relationships that require a perceiving organism. Ignorance. The core defining characteristic of ignorant behavior is perceiving everything external to oneself, subject, as an object suitable to be used in any way one sees fit to meet one's needs and especially wants, egocentric. A want in this case is something that one has no objective need for but has acquired a desire to possess or consume in some manner. Objects external to the self can be anything, including inanimate objects, social phenomena, plants, animals, and especially other people. The question naturally arises as to why the material universe and subject-object relations exist. One perspective is that they exist to provide source with an experiential context. Creation of an experiential context suggests that source is engaged in self-exploration. The material universe then is an artifact of source or consciousness that has rendered a portion of itself ignorant of the rest so that dualistic representations of itself can interact. One might think of the material universe as a canvas created by an artist for the development of his or her creative talents. In short, the dynamic interactions that we think of as life are permutations of subject-object relations grounded in source. Ultimately speaking, subject and object are one, and the material universe of separate parts is an illusion. Human beings represent an important component of the material world simply because their capabilities greatly expand the range of experience possible. The key psychological component governing most subject-object interactions involving human beings is ego. Ego is the identity cloaking that portion of source manifesting through human forms. The development of ego draws a veil between self and source, thereby creating the dualistic illusion of me and not me. Everything animate and non-animate beyond one's self-awareness is not me. Good and evil, therefore, represent a dualistic or complementary pair of constructs that can be applied to intentional actions by ego in the material world. This dichotomy is, like all dichotomies, ultimately an illusion, because source is beyond dichotomies. It is a spiritual singularity or indivisible whole. However, it is a very real dichotomy for individuals lacking direct experience of source and, therefore, awareness of the illusion. If source created the material universe in order to impose a counterpoint to itself for the purpose of gaining experience, then the struggle between good and evil would appear to be an important and necessary dimension of experience. In other terms, good and evil can be thought of as the difference between enlightened actions and actions grounded in ignorance. When construed in this way, actions grounded in ignorance blind one to one's true nature, that is, as an aspect of source or God. Thus, evil arises out of spiritual ignorance that leads one to invest one's sense of being in ego or one's fictive self. Life then consists of each individual's struggle to overcome ignorance and thereby achieve enlightenment. This dichotomy between enlightenment and ignorance might be thought of as a complementary pair, where one end is anchored by selflessness, loving, kindness, and the other end is anchored by selfishness, egotism. The further one's identity falls toward the selfishness or egotism end of the scale, the greater one's ignorance and the potential for evil actions. An interviewer at the Nuremberg trials for Nazi war criminals was asked if he had learned anything from his interviews. He replied that what he had learned was that evil was the total absence of empathy. Empathy can be construed as the ability to expand one's sense of me to include others. Carried to its logical conclusion, this inclusive expansion submerges ego and becomes selflessness, which is the antithesis of me or ego. True selflessness requires the evolution of consciousness, which requires the expansion of empathy that leads to a life grounded in compassion and love. Evil then in this scheme of reasoning arises from attempts to gratify ego desires. Desire is what one wants as distinct from what one needs. One needs shelter but wants a penthouse apartment on Affluence Avenue. Desires are rooted in status-seeking, righteousness, jealousy, lust, pride, power, honor, envy, fame and fortune, along with many other similar obstacles to the expansion of empathy, spiritual development, and enlightenment. When objects are perceived by ego as merely means to satisfy desire, they have no inherent value independent of one's use of them. People, animals, plants, and physical elements are all treated as objects for satisfying one's desires. The desires of ego are an expression of ignorance and the source of evil in the world. Satan, in Christian theology, might be thought of as the personification of ego desire. Thus, to be consumed by the fires of ego desire is, metaphorically speaking, to be in hell. Equating self with ego is the initial step leading to treating others as objects. Think of this initial step as ego becoming an image manager. We are almost all image managers to some degree. The greater the degree to which we engage in image management, the greater the extent of our self-absorption. An image manager desires ego to be viewed by others in a particular persona. Sometimes one has an intentionally constructed public persona and a private persona that differ from one another. Both will involve some degree of deception. A public persona deceives others while the private persona deceives self. Self-deception perpetuates ignorance, which can only be avoided by not equating self with ego. The ego, as image manager, makes choices that are believed to maintain or enhance ego's self-image or self-conception. A self-image can embody a positive or negative persona depending upon the purposes that it serves. Ego affects choices about things that include but aren't limited to one's personal narrative, physical appearance, possessions, public behavior, employment, social and intimate relationships. Image management is about me, ego. I'm an important person, I have authority, I'm no good, I'm a victim, I'm beautiful, I'm handsome, I'm entitled, I'm helpless, I'm popular or even I'm spiritual, among many others. Once one has a me narrative, then that narrative begins to rationalize much of what one does. Ego becomes fully self-absorbed, and to be self-absorbed implies that one has a selfish identity. A selfish identity means one acts from ignorance, which makes one highly susceptible to engaging in what might be perceived as evil. Evil is not dependent upon any particular act but rather on the intent of the actor. To do harm to another individual unintentionally is not evil. The same harm resulting from an intentional act committed in the service of ego desire is evil. Graduations of evil or ignorant actions depend upon the degree of damage to objects that result from the satisfaction of the ego's desires. The nature of the harm, whether physical, psychological, social or economic, is less important than the degree of damage knowingly caused. Evil of whatever degree is subject to escalation through the power of an egoist to impose his or her desire broadly. Given someone with power willing to cause damage in the service of ego desire, the evil will be multiplied. Acts affecting groups of people are greater evils than comparable solitary acts, simply due to the multiplicative effect of power in the service of ego desire. Another consideration is complicity in evil through support for or ignoring the action of others, the outcomes of which serve one's own ego desires. Bystanders are not necessarily innocent but may be passive partners in evil actions and thereby bear part of the burden of such evil. A final consideration is acts that take on the appearance of being motivated by good intentions. Surely, there are selfless acts motivated by good intentions. However, the criterion for evil offered herein pertains to acts motivated by ego desire. A benefit that accrues as a result of actions motivated by ego does not justify the actions or neutralize the evil. The point is simply that there is, in some manner of speaking, a continuum of sorts along which one might arrange acts of evil with varying degrees of precision. While all actions in the service of ego desire are, by definition, evil, there are lesser and greater evils among them. A question can also be raised about evil and the satisfaction of life-sustaining needs. This poses a fundamental question about natural rights. When a mountain lion kills a deer for food, we would not describe this action as evil. It is the natural right of the lion to acquire sustenance from its environment. In the case of human beings, it might also be argued that they have a natural right to meet their life-sustaining needs. One could argue that a human animal has the same natural rights as a lion, and taking its sustenance by force, when necessary, is no more evil than the taking by the lion. Evil would be avoided, however, only by using no more force than is necessary, taking only the minimum that is needed or a fair apportionment, whichever is less. Even so, an enlightened individual would recognize that the situation is simply one act in an evolving human drama intended to provide opportunities to overcome ignorance. Thus, such an enlightened individual might refuse to participate in the drama and accept the consequences. By doing so, the enlightened individual maintains detachment from the drama of the material world while serving as an example to others and possibly contributing to their spiritual advancement. Finally, there is the general question of how should one respond to evil action? This will depend upon the development of one's sense of selflessness. Someone operating from the selfish side of the identity scale will respond in kind and strike back in anger with a desire for revenge and thereby perpetuate ignorance. This is the morality of retribution. If a direct response isn't possible or avoided out of fear, the object of the evil action may at least harbor ill will, hatred, toward the perpetrator, which will also serve to perpetuate ignorance. In the case of a response to an unprovoked action engaged in for defensive reasons, even if the defensive actions are in kind, they are not evil. A purely reflexive defensive action may be grounded in ignorance, but it isn't an intentional attempt to satisfy ego desire. It is ignorant because the defender has not learned the negative moral implications of emotionally motivated in-kind counter-aggression. This is, of course, the way the majority of human beings can be expected to act, which often leads to an escalating cycle of response and counter-response. Ignorance follows the path of least resistance, and ignorance is the soil in which evil takes root. A person making a moderate response will probably engage in defensive counter-aggression but without emotional content. In other words, an emotionally detached response is more likely to be a constrained response. Someone operating from the selflessness side of the identity scale will recognize the evil nature of the attack and the need for a measured response. Such an individual will engage in counter-aggression as a last resort and will then only do so with emotional detachment. Finally, a fully selfless and enlightened person who is the object of evil action might embrace and absorb the action to the point of physical annihilation, knowing that the action cannot do any real injury and recognizing that such a response to evil may serve as an instructional demonstration. In conclusion, an undeveloped or underdeveloped sense of empathy is clearly an obstacle to spiritual growth. Thus, being ruled by ego desire and thereby satisfying one's wants through treating everything that is not me as an object with no purpose but to serve one's desires blocks the path to spiritual development. To open the path to spiritual development requires a freely made choice to let go of attachments to wants and expand one's sense of empathy through identification and perspective taking until ignorance and selfishness are crowded out by love and compassion. When the spiritual path is freely embraced, one has taken one giant step in the evolution of consciousness, selflessness, and enlightenment. Enlightenment. The core defining characteristic of enlightenment is self-realization or recognition that one's consciousness is in fact not a separate phenomenon but is a manifestation of source consciousness, which becomes more available through enlightenment. Some subject-object functioning remains necessary even for a self-realized person, due to the necessity of operating in a relativistic context. However, egocentric wants will no longer drive the motivational state of such persons, and thus they will not view objects in the world to be simple means to an end. Earlier, the natural mind was described as a state of functioning that is virtually ego-free but without full self-realization, ego-free in the sense that one identifies with conscious awareness rather than the body-mind. Rupert Spira, a teacher of non-dual philosophy and practice, has said that this is a halfway point between ignorance and self-realization. The natural mind is also a state relatively free from conditioned or automatic programs, especially those with a negative cast, that usually play a large part in one's emotional behavioral functioning. Methods for working on conditioned, automatic programs, APs, is the topic of the earlier part of this book. These APs are acquired largely through our socialization and come to be organized around and understood through a narrative, which may consist of multiple but related stories constructed from our experiences and our memories of them. My term for this narrative is the fictive self. Neutralizing many of our conditioned ways of interpreting the physical and social environment facilitates becoming free of ego-driven thinking, feeling, and acting, i.e., deconstructing and ending our identification with the fictive self. Once operating from the natural mind, one is available for, i.e., not resisting, a transformation of consciousness through an opening to source. This is not, however, something that one can make happen but must allow to take one as discussed earlier. As long as one lives in the relative world, there will be choices arising out of the dualistic underpinnings of relative reality. In a book by John Mark Hammer, an interesting distinction was drawn. Hammer referred to the earth and the world as being distinct. The former is Gaia-like, which according to Wikipedia, refers to a hypothesis proposing that, organisms interact with their inorganic surroundings on Earth to form a self-regulating, complex system that contributes to maintaining the conditions for life on the planet. Hammer would go one step further and say that this complex system is an organism and that all components of it arise out of consciousness and to varying degrees possess consciousness. The world according to Hammer is a complex of ideas, concepts, beliefs, and expectations that govern a drama called human culture and civilization performed on a stage called Earth. Hammer's drama recalls to mind some lines from the poem titled Outlaw that ended chapter 4. Several pertinent lines from that poem follow. And the man knew God. And he was made free. All history and tradition. Culture and words. Rescinded, grace. Freedom from the past. And from the future. An outlaw. Eckhart Tolle makes a similar distinction, albeit on a smaller scale. He speaks of one's life situation versus one's life. Your life situation is analogous to how you stand in relation to the world. Your life is related to your role as one of the biological organisms of which the earth is partially comprised. The world and life situations are governed by the mind while the earth and life are governed by natural processes. As discussed earlier, the world can be thought of as a large web spun around the earth. The strands comprising this web can, for example, be thought of, but not limited to, political systems and ideologies, systems of law and concepts of justice, economic and financial systems, occupations, art, music, fashion, religions, philosophies, moral systems, science and technology, social organizations, educational systems, systems of kinship and social classes based on maternity and paternity, race, ethnicity, wealth, gender, and various other characteristics. One's life situation results from the strands in the web of the world one identifies with and uses to define oneself. If all human life were eliminated from the earth, what would happen to this web comprising the world that most of us think of as reality? Most of it would vanish almost instantly, clearly showing that it was not real at all but simply a product of the mind. What would happen to the earth and life? They would still be here and would continue on following the natural processes that have always ordered them. A person acting from a conditioned mind is entangled in the world and cannot see beyond it. When one is functioning from a conditioned mind or ego, choices are ruled by APs, which are conditioned programs, many of which reflect beliefs, opinions, and expectations that we have adopted that are related to the world. Such choices are often described as judgments or prejudices. Someone who has regained their natural mind acts through the application of naive thought and intuitive discernment. Thus, the natural mind functions in the world through bottom-up perception. Discernment means seeing the unfiltered nature of things or seeing through the web. Thus, The natural mind must weave its way through the world, distinguishing between essential and superficial characteristics when choices must be made. Do understand that the web comprising the world is not an illusion and has real consequences that one must take into account. However, the natural mind helps give one a perspective on the web that opens the possibility of navigating it without becoming lost in it. The American mystic Franklin Merrill Wolfe spoke of what he called the high indifference, by which he seemed to be referring to this ability to rise above the web and gain some perspective on it. This does not mean one is indifferent to the real needs of the living, but only that one responds to them independent of egoistic influences. While Merrill Wolfe recognized that it is virtually impossible to completely disengage from the world, he thought that one could function in the world without being of the world. The natural mind is grounded in life and being, not in the world of the mind, or as Leonard Jacobson often says, in the world of time. Some choices involve simple preferences. For example, given a choice between several flavors of creamer for your coffee, personal preferences are adequate for making a choice. However, having found your way back to the natural mind, one no longer has beliefs and opinions, prejudgments, to rely upon in making many choices. One is left with naive thought and intuitive discernment as the basis for making these choices. This means carefully considering the worldly context for a choice and then determining an independent course of action in the present circumstance that is best suited to the true requirements of the situation. Such choices seem to be close to what the Buddhists mean by right action. There are no hard and fast rules for right action. However, if one approaches decision points without being entangled in and identified with the world, one will usually arrive at the right action. This may simply flow from an unencumbered understanding, or it may be informed by intuitive discernment about what to do. If right action isn't apparent, don't rush, allow the situation to settle into the natural mind and wait for an insight into right action. For those who have freed themselves from the conditioned mind, right action arises from the heart.